A few years ago, the writer Robert McFarlane went on a long walk. It was a series of long walks, actually, in his native England. The British have a long history of walking, and he wanted to explore some of these ancient paths. They're known as the Old Ways. And it was on one of the Old Ways, in the South Downs in West Sussex, where he encountered, well, a ghost.
The South Downs are one of the big chalk ridges or ranges that run across southern England. It runs from Winchester in the west to Eastbourne on the English Channel by the famous White Cliffs in the east. And I walked that because I'd wanted to for many years. I was walking alone, and I'd covered some fairly long distances, dodging storms. And I was sleeping out as I went. I'd heard a little bit about Chanctonbury Ring. It was, from the late 18th century onwards, a very distinctive landmark. It was planted with beech trees, and it became this tremendous sort of hilltop grove of these splendid copper-leaved, silver-trunked beech trees. I made my way up there at the end of a long, leg-tired day and settled in, tucked into my little sleeping bag under the trees. Night fell, I was very happy, that lovely feeling you have at the end of a long day when you have the stars as your sky. And at about 2 a.m., something happened that I won't ever forget and still can't explain. I heard the first scream at around 2 o'clock in the morning. A high-pitched and human cry, protracted but falling away in its closing phase. It came from the opposite side of the tree ring to where I was sleeping. My thoughts were sleep-muddled. A child in distress, a rabbit being taken by a weasel or a fox. That was impossible, though. The sound was coming at least from treetop height. A bird, then. An owl, surely. But this was like no owl I'd ever heard before. Not the furry hoot of a tawny or the screech of a barn owl. I felt a faint rasp of fear, dismissed it as ridiculous. Then another cry joined the first, different in tone, slightly deeper and more grainy, rising at its end, the shriek of a blade laid hard to a lathe, also more human than avian, also unrecognizable to me, coming also from treetop height. I lay there for 2 or 3 minutes listening to the screams, and then I realized, with a prickling in my shoulders and fingers, that the voices had split and were now coming towards me, still at treetop height, but circling round the tree ring, one clockwise and one anti-clockwise, converging roughly on where I was lying. I felt like standing up, shouting, flashing a torch, but instead, I lay still and hoped it would all end. The cries met each other almost directly above me, 20 or 30 feet up in the dark. After 15 minutes or so, they stopped, and eventually, uneasily, I fell back to sleep. There is a huge supernatural lore surrounding Chanctonbury Ring, but I didn't know any of it when I slept there. I don't explain it. I can't really. There are many kinds of walking, not always recreational or visionary. The walking that I was particularly interested in this period of my walking life, as it were, was following what I call old ways, old paths. Not roads, not tarmacked surfaces, but ways that have been beaten into the earth by the passage of many feet. When you walk a path, an old path, it's impossible not to think of who's walked it before. They are your ghosts, your co-walkers in time. That's what pulls my mind back.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. We're talking about walking today, because we're all doing so much more of it these days. And a walk can break up the monotony of isolation, but there's so much more to be found on one. Like McFarlane says, yourself. A connection to the landscape around you and the people you meet or will meet once we get closer again. McFarlane is a fellow of Emmanuel College at Cambridge University, and a few years ago he wrote this beautiful, lyrical book about his journey by foot of 1,000 miles or so. It's called The Old Ways. And it's a book, he says, he couldn't have written by sitting still.
It's slightly untrue in that writing is on the whole a sedentary business, and I read my way into these landscapes as well. A lot of that happened kind of sitting still, as it were. But I'm deeply interested in the philosophical proposition, which again is not an absolute rule, but can hold powerfully true. I think that there are certain kinds of thinking that are best undertaken, and indeed can only happen when you are walking, when your body is moving, when the rhythm of limbs, of the beat of the placed and lifted foot is in action. Nietzsche predictably is very direct about this. He says only those thoughts which come from walking have any value. Well, you'd expect that from Mr. Nietzsche, but he's right. Wrong, of course. but I think there are some which are. What I mean by that is that I could not have thought this book into being without having walked this book into being.
I wonder, are you doing more walking these days? And I ask it for obvious reasons. I wonder what you make of the fact that people are going out, of course, when they can responsibly and walking. And I wonder are they just killing time? Are they trying to break out of boredom? Or do you see something else going on there?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, this vast, terrible social experiment that we're all performing right now is revealing things as well as burying and suppressing them and all the pain that is being caused as well. I think there are two answers to that. One is that boredom is strong, right? There's an amazing book, you may have heard of it. People are talking about it. I read it long before this, but thought of it shortly after lockdown came in. It was published in 1794 by a French writer called Xavier de Maistre, and it's called Voyage autour de ma chambre, Voyage around my room. And he gets locked up after a duel. He's arrested after a duel in Turin, in northern Italy. And he is confined to a 36-foot perimeter room for exactly 6 weeks, which I suspect is precisely the length of lockdown that we here in the UK will be enduring. And he writes this brilliant parody of what it's like to be an explorer of an ultra confined space. And he has, what's he write? How's he put it? He says something like, "When I travel through my room, I rarely follow a straight line. I go from the table towards a picture hanging in the corner, and from there I set out obliquely towards the door." So it becomes this great mock travelogue about how you can travel within a confined space. So I think on the one hand we're doing that. On the other, you're right, these walks that we're taking have become profoundly valuable. Walks that we kind of wouldn't give a second thought to, indeed probably wouldn't take, have now become these lifelines. They're not cures, they're not inoculations, but they are powerful consolations. People are looking differently at the world as spring breaks over us, as this pandemic also breaks over us. They're repeating walks, so they're seeing the same route differently each day as the seasons change, as the backgrounds change. They're making new paths, these incredible, what we might call sort of coronavirus desire lines, where people are having to walk 2 meters away from one another. So paths are getting wider and wider and wider as people step away.
Yeah.
Are you seeing those?
Absolutely. I hadn't thought of it that way, but you're right. They're not so narrow anymore, at least not these days.
No, which is sad, yeah. But also it's old. I mean, before enclosure in this country, before land was privatized, paths were wide things. They were like rivers, big Mississippi rivers. The Icknield Way, which runs on the chalk, which I write about in the book, was in places up to a mile wide, because when one bit of the path got too deep for feet or too muddy for cartwheels, they would just move 2 yards to the left, and so on and so forth. So in an odd way, we're making paths now as we were 300 years ago.
How do you explain the lure of a path? Because you mentioned in the book how our eyes are enticed by them, and our imagination is too. Our minds, you say, can't help but pursue a line in the land. What do you make of that?
Well, maybe I should ask you if that's, is that true of you as well, Doug? Because I'm writing from my perspective, a kind of path obsessive. So I know it might be a bit perplexing to others, but do you get that too?
Absolutely. I think even on paths that I walk a lot, and I do, there's a path that I hike all the time, and I know it really well, but there is always something different about it, because it's not a concrete or an asphalt path. It's a path mm-hmm. in the foothills, and so it's always different in some way. And so there is always something, it seems to me, that is drawing you along. There is still that curiosity of what might be different around the bend.
Yeah, I think that's really nicely put. And I like the idea of a footpath in foothills. And we talk about footage in terms of film, right? A film unfolds through its footage, but a walk unfolds through its footage as well. And paths are plots, they're stories. And to read them, we have to walk them. It's no coincidence that a print is what we call both the mark left by a foot and the mark left by a letter. And the oldest of stories is a walk. The oldest written story that we know of really is the Epic of Gilgamesh from Sumeria, 2400 BC circa. And it's about walking. Enkidu and Gilgamesh walk to the cedar forest. Enkidu walks to the city. And as it happens, I'm working with a wonderful musician friend, Johnny Flynn, right now, and we're making songs together about walking based on Gilgamesh. So I think there's a lot of sublimated walking happening now, stories that are being told actually while sitting still, mostly.
Early on in the book, you write about walking one particular moment just after a snowstorm, and the path you described in the book as a young way. And of course, the title is The Old Ways. What are the paths you refer to as the old ways? You mentioned still lots of places with lots of them, and you mentioned how you can find these old ways everywhere.
Yeah, well, I think you can. I mean, so I live in a suburb just about a mile from the edge of my city of Cambridge in the UK. So if you walk that half mile to the edge of the city, as I did today, actually I was running it, then I jump onto this young way, this little field path, which is probably only about 40-50 years old and is in fact about to be developed into invisibility, eliminated, but that's fine. The city needs to grow. That intersects with a Roman road, so 2000 years old. The Roman road intersects with a probably Neolithic pathway, certainly passes through Bronze Age and Iron Age tracks and probably overlays a Neolithic route. So we're already, you walk 2 miles from my house and you're 5,000 years back in time. So I guess that's what I mean, is that distance is measured in time as well as space. And obviously America has a less It has a less evidence in terms of landmarks of a continuous history of occupation, but of course there's very long-standing indigenous occupation in North America, and many of those tracks have been the basis of modern roads, modern ways. So, yeah, I think tracks tell stories backwards in time as well as forwards in space.
I like how you mention an old way in the United States, the bison roads.
Yeah, but bison roads, I don't know so much about this, but I mean, obviously you had vast herds, millions of kilos of bison beef on the hoof, as it were, before the slaughter happened in the 19th century. And they moved. They migrated in search of food, and they made paths as they went. And the huge biomass, buffalo biomass, left these great paths in the landscape, great tracks. So these were actually then followed by the early settlers who pushed westwards across the Great Plains, because they were helpful landmarks, and the ground had been cleared by the buffalo. So this is an example of sort of human, more than human, co-path making, which is deeply inscribed into the ecological and cultural history of North America.
You write about the Western Apache, how they think of the past as a path, and then how other Native peoples, I think from Western Canada, you write about, have like an interchangeable term for footprint and knowledge. They use them in the similar ways.
Yeah, this is I'm always interested in what is discovered by modern Western cultures and touted as discovery has almost always been self-evident to indigenous cultures.
Right.
And that's pretty much the case here. There's a word in Tibetan, shul, which means a sort of mark, an impress, a hollow, which is also a sort of memory, a memory trace, as it were. So, I mean, this compact between knowledge and footfall, if you like, is really old. And it's in language too. Language has roots in both senses. It moves backwards in time. You can follow etymologies like paths or like plant roots backwards. And there's a wonderful one that connects our very everyday modern verb to learn. But if you follow that back, you get into a very old Germanic root, lijnoen, which means to find or follow a track. So, and that takes us back again into the Proto-Indo-European. There's a stem, lice, which L-E-I-S, which means track as well. So there's a very old buried connection between knowledge and following a track, walking.
I guess the best footpaths are the ones that are open to everyone. And you mentioned the British system of footpaths, which is legendary, I think, for most of us. The Scandinavians are good at this too, right? A system of pathways that is basically everyone has access to. It's everyone's right, these paths.
Well, this is really interesting and really politically live. So the Scandinavian system, which actually now is Scotland, resembles in it, with its devolved government north of our border, it's called Allemannsretten. Every man's right, or every person's right. In Scotland, it's known colloquially as the right to roam. And actually, this sort of supersedes paths. It says we don't need paths to go anywhere. There are large areas of open country above certain altitudes, certain kinds of land, which you can just be in. You can access. You can sleep in. You can make fires in. You can hunt in. You can fish in within certain regulation. I mean, this is radical stuff. It's absolutely self-evident to the Scandinavians, and it's now sacred in Scotland. So the footpaths are a sort of middle ground between that ultimate freedom and then what I might call the American example or the Irish example of, you know, fully privatized land,
yeah,
fully private land versus public lands of various kinds, and as I understand it, you know, if you have private land, you're not going to let a, you know, a footpath can't run through it by order of the state. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. It is right. In fact, the same applies, at least in the West or this part of the West, to rivers. You can't access private sections of rivers. It's been quite a political debate around here for the past few years.
Yeah, well, it is in England too. And so in England we have, and Wales, which is different to Scotland, therefore, and Northern Ireland, which is different to Ireland again. We have this fabulous system of footpaths. So we have, depending on how you measure it, somewhere between 130,000, 170,000 miles of footpaths. And they form this fabulous sort of, I call it this labyrinth of liberty. So a footpath, to eradicate a footpath or change a footpath is really legislatively challenging. They are heavily protected in law. So landowners can't just decide they're going to block off an existing recorded footpath. They would theoretically have to go to the Secretary of State to do that. So this is kind of fabulous and inspiring protection of the right to walk. But what you can't do is step off those footpaths. So that's what I mean about the footpath network being, on the one hand, an expression of wonderful access, that it penetrates all this private land, otherwise hard to access land. It means you could literally set off walking and never stop in your life without stepping off a public footpath. But it does also mean that when you're on it, the trade-off is you can't leave it. You can't leave a footpath.
Robert McFarlane. We're talking about his book, The Old Ways, A Journey on Foot. He's also the author, most recently, of the book, Underland, A Deep Time Journey. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
With KUER's mobile app, you can listen to our live programming stream, enjoy podcasts like Radio West and Preach, browse local news, and access our 24/7 streams of BBC World Service and classical music. You can also use the new Station Finder tool to locate the KUER radio frequency that's closest to you. And if you have CarPlay in your vehicle, our app is now compatible. The KUER mobile app is available for iPhone and Android wherever you get your apps.
This is Radio West, and Doug Fabrizio. The writer Robert McFarlane is joining us today to talk about the joys and the sorrows and the gifts of walking. He's a walker himself, always has been, and a few years ago he wrote a book that explores what he called the ghosts and voices that haunt ancient paths. It's a book, he says, that is about people and place and how walking can reorient us inward. There's some great walkers in history, and you mentioned some of them in your writing. Just say something about William Wordsworth. It seems his stamina sounds amazing.
Well, the first thing to say about William Wordsworth, is that he had really knobbly knees.
Right.
So Thomas de Quincey, who was another of the late 18th century romantics, famous opium smoker and so forth, another amazing writer, but he liked to tease Wordsworth about his knobbly legs. I'd take knobbly knees if I could walk as far as Wordsworth did. I mean, he probably walked about 150,000 miles in his life. Hard to estimate, but he would think nothing of walking, 20 to 30 miles across the Lake District, across rough country, to visit Coleridge or to see a waterfall, or this was a sort of daily toll, as it were, except he didn't think of it as a toll. He was an extraordinary walker, and he would also famously compose verse while walking. So I often think the difference between Coleridge and Wordsworth is that Wordsworth liked sort of level ground to compose on. So he was the master of the blank pentameter, whereas Coleridge was, he liked rougher ground. He was a wilder writer, a wilder prosodist.
How much do we know about Darwin's sand path and how that imbued him with, you know, ideas that would change the world.
Yeah, this is a really interesting one. I mean, go back here to that idea of, you know, Nietzsche being an absolute dogmatist about how only the thoughts that come from walking have any value. Well, that's wrong, but I probably you're the same, Doug. I mean, when I have a knotty problem, I try and walk it out or run it out. And it's almost by not thinking about something, perhaps, that, or by setting your body in motion, that you begin to think slightly differently, see around the edges of a crux. So Darwin had this sandy walk near his house, and allegedly he would complete a loop of this path and use it to think his way through knotty problems. And he would put flints at a little pile of flints at the start of the path, and would sort of knock them away when he completed a circuit, in this way keeping a tally of what he was doing. And so we think, so allegedly he would, you know, if he had a really tricky problem, it was a three flint problem. And I really like that idea. You know, if only my mind worked as fast as Darwin's, then, you know, three loops of the sandy path and you've solved evolution.
Well, isn't the heart of the book that connection between writing and walking?
Yes, I guess so. I mean, I say somewhere paths run through people as surely as they run through places. And for me, that's probably the heart of the book more than the connection between writing. I mean, I'm always fascinated in how we set landscapes reverberating metaphorically and metaphysically within our sort of belief systems and our individual spirits, if we might call them that. So, you know, the way of life, the path of life is probably the oldest metaphor for being, for moving through the world over the course of one's existence. And it's there across cultures. I spent about 6 years writing The Old Ways. I then spent 7 years writing a book called Underland, which was about one of the other great persistent metaphors, which is that of death as an underworld, death as and darkness and vision as that which lies beneath us. So I guess we could say those are two of the great metaphors for making sense of the vast mystery of human being, that we follow the path of life and we eventually dive into the darkness of unknowing and death. So of course each culture and each individual reverberates very differently with these ways of making sense of ourselves, but in that way we draw the outside into ourselves. We have geographies of the soul. There's a lovely John Muir quote. He says, very famous, it was the epigraph to another book I wrote. He says, "I only went out for a walk, but decided to stay out till sundown, for going out, I found, was really going in." And yeah. I think that kind of nails it for me.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned how Muir had this belief in kind of the transformative power of a walker's, this is how we put it, you cited in the book, a walker's bodily contact with the wild world. This part seems to interest you too, that connection with landscape.
Yeah, well, we touch the world most with our feet.
Yeah,
we wear shoes, of course, now mostly. Although I have done a fair bit of barefoot walking,
yeah,
sometimes to the end of great pain, but sometimes to the end of great pleasure as well. But our feet are our main touch with the world, and we are born with folded soles. In several senses, but our feet have already been walking in the black space of the womb. We need the world with our feet. That's what presses against the belly of the mother. And so when we come out, we've already been astronaut walkers, and then we lay our feet in contact with the earth, and that becomes, for most people, those who remain upright and are lucky to be able to walk, that becomes the main point, the place where we ground and earth ourselves, as it were. I would say something about female walkers, actually, because all the names we've mentioned are men so far, and there is a very strong gender bias in the history of walking, which I think is pretty easy to explain in a way, that a lot of walking and thinking and writing has been done by men who walk alone, and walking alone has historically either been risky for women or has been sort of culturally censored, as it were, that a lone female walker might be might be something like a prostitute, might be someone either vulnerable or available. So it's been really hard for female walkers, but there are, of course, some extraordinary ones within the world of writing. And one of them is Nan Shepherd, this yeah. Scottish writer who I have a longstanding vast admiration for, who was walking into the Cairngorms in the early part of the 20th century mountain range in northeast Scotland. And she walked, thinking about the question you asked me, she writes wonderfully. She says, hour upon the mountain, I walk the flesh transparent. And it's at once this beautiful fulfillment of the body, that you come to know your body in ways that for Nan, I think, were quite erotic. Mm. She lived a predominantly celibate life. And I think she felt most erotic when she was in the mountains, that it filled and thrilled her body in ways that, you know, running water, wind, snow, light, these were wondrous things to her. So on the one hand, the flesh is made transparent, and on the other, it's fulfilled. And I think anyone who's walked a really long distance in stunning landscape will know some version of that doubleness.
Makes me think about the part in the book where you say you prefer to think about these old ways, these paths, as ways of walking that, here's how you put it, that enables sight and thought rather than encourages retreat and escape. Would you talk about the difference there? Because yes, I guess this gets us to the idea of being drawn inward.
Yes, it does. I think it also gets us away from something. And that this may be peculiar to the British tradition, although of walking and thinking, though I'd be surprised if it were, which is that old ways have often been used as, you know, very sort of conservative forms that draw people, that sort of say, well, let's follow this old path and it will take us back to that which is valuable in the Neolithic, or that which we'd lost from the Roman or whatever. And on the one hand, I'm sympathetic to that, but on the other, I'm wary of it. So I guess I am excited by the idea that paths open us up to the world. They make us sensitive. They open us to encounter as well. If you're in a car, you're driving past another car driver, the most you're likely to do is hoot a horn at them, probably. If you're walking, you're not shelled, you're not enclosed in your vehicle, so you stop and talk. I guess I do. I love chatting to people on the path. It seems like we don't do so much of it these days, but you know, the hospitality, the openness of encounter, the visions and the surprises that come when walking, these interest me.
It does seem that walking has some kind of, and I don't want to overthink this because it's, but it does have some kind of healing effect for some. I mean, you write about how many of the British soldiers returning from World War I ended up doing a lot of walking, in some cases, because they had to look for work, but in other cases they were looking for some kind of, I don't know, some kind of solitude or solace or something.
Solace, yes. I think that's right. And I guess I've always been interested in this relationship between particularly depression and walking. It's really striking how many depressives are walkers. And I think this is George Borrow's very extraordinary 19th century British Anglo-Welsh walker, Edward Thomas, who we've touched on already, this poet who was passed through profound depressive episodes. Yeah, they tried to outwalk the black dog, as it were. And they didn't always manage it. Sometimes we all know it, the dog just tags along at your heel. It's your shadow. You can't, the lead is stuck to your wrist and you can't get rid of it. But other times you do leave it behind. And again, perhaps we're back to this sense of the body being open to a world beyond the mind, that enclosure, that feeling of ashes and in the mouth and confinement in the skull that accompanies depression is possibly modified and helped by encounter with a living world and a moving world beyond the confines of the brain.
I love this story. It's just a brief story that you tell in the book about encountering a man named Lewis, who started you sort of came upon him. You were walking somewhat quicker than he was, but you started talking with him, and he tells you about how he had started walking after his after his wife died.
Mm. Yeah, Lewis, you're taking me right back now. I can see it in my mind's eye. And I'd just seen a, this is nearly over 10 years ago now, but I'd just seen a barn owl hunting over the reeds, and beautiful ghost of the day of a bird, and fell in beside Lewis, and he had a couple of Coke bottles stuck in the side of this big pack, and that he had his water in it. You can tell when, I mean, people, stage walkers out there will, among your listeners will know, you start to read people's packs and their boots, right? It tells you what kind of a walker they are, what they're up to. And I could tell this was a very well-organized pack. This was somebody who was out a lot. And so it proved, I mean, he basically tried to walk away from his grief, and he'd never stopped. And the other extraordinary thing was that he kept journals of what he was doing, these black and red books that he was telling me about, that he would just write these diaries, these incredible walking diaries. I mean, I don't know that they were stylistically remarkable, but I do know that they were the account of a remarkable and quietly modest life. And he would then send them, I think, to his brother, who did have a house, and his brother kept them for him. And I often wonder what became of that library of this one life. And I again and again, bumped, you know, met people or heard stories of people who were walking to get away from sadness of one kind or another.
Well, I think this gets us to a major figure in the book and in your life, I think, Edward Thomas. You call him the guiding spirit in the book. Tell us about him.
Well, he's probably a name unfamiliar to most of your listeners. I may be wrong there. I'd be delighted to be wrong. I guess he would be called a First World War poet here. He was killed on the first day of the Battle of Arras in 1917, after the battle was really done. It seems he was killed probably by the passage of a stray shell that collapsed his lungs, flung him unmarked and dead to the earth near his dugout. He was an observation officer for an artillery regiment on the Western Front. And he had been a writer of note, but of prose predominantly, for about 20, 30 years. He was a biographer. He was a naturalist, natural historian. He was what we would probably call a travel writer today. He wrote books about walking and nature and people. But in 1914, something extraordinary happened. He started to write poems, and he did so at the encouragement of Robert Frost, a name that will be known to pretty much everyone there, who he began walking with in 1913 in Gloucestershire and became very close to. And Frost said, look, you're a poet, but you're burying your poems in prose. And Frost did this beautiful sort of geological thing. He kind of took the equivalent of a fossil hunter's pick, and he chiseled out a few lines of Thomas's prose, and then he arranged them as poems. And he said, look, this is a poem. It's already there. It's like a fossil in the strata of your prose. And Thomas began writing, and he wrote about 140-odd poems between 1914 and 1916. Late 1916, perhaps early 1917, not long before he embarked for the Western Front. And these poems are astonishing. They changed the course of English poetry. Ted Hughes, one of our poet laureates, called Thomas the father of us all. And they're the influence of this small body of work by this man who wasn't a poet for most of his life has been astonishing. So, a walker, a writer, a dreamer. He smoked a briarwood pipe. He tailored the pockets of his jackets extra wide so he could pick up fruit and nuts and bits and bobs as he walked. And a depressive. And yeah, in a way, a man who was killed because he felt he ought to fight when he had no need in the end to fight.
He was going back and forth in his mind about whether he should enlist. Mind you, he was 36 at the time when he was considering all of this. And it was, in fact, a Robert Frost poem that seemed to push him forward to enlist.
Yeah, so probably the most famous poem, arguably, in the modern American canon. Many people will be able to complete the lines. Two roads diverged in a yellow wood, and sorry I could not travel both and be one traveler, long I stood, dot, dot, dot. Yeah. And it's a poem, a fabulously famous, wonderful, kind of irresolvable poem about indecision that itself takes multiple paths, that branches and doesn't necessarily reconverge. It's about how we read a poem and come to one conclusion and cannot come to another, but it's also about how we make decisions in the path of life. And Thomas was he sent it to Thomas early on in draft, and Thomas was stung by it. He felt it was a veiled, it wasn't, but he felt it was a veiled allusion to Thomas's own indecisions, an indecision on the one hand about bravery in the face of crisis. He and Frost had once confronted a gamekeeper while they were out walking together. Frost had been strong, stepped forward, told the gamekeeper where to shove his private land, and Thomas had dithered and hung back. But also a veiled sort of dig at Thomas's indecision over whether to enlist in the First World War. And not long after he read that poem, he signed up. And from there, in a way, his death was a foregone conclusion.
You write about how on one foot journey that you took, you tried to memorize Thomas's poem, Rhodes. Hmm. Did you ever manage it?
I got a fair bit into it. I'll give you the first two stanzas if you want. I can get this right. Rhodes. I love Rhodes. The goddesses that dwell far along invisible are my favorite gods. Rhodes go on while we forget and are forgotten like a star that shoots and is gone. I could do the whole thing back in the day, but I think it'll start to fray a bit if I push it any further. But that wonderful first line, I love roads. By roads, he means paths. Yeah.
I love roads. You say that you came to think of Edward Thomas's writing as a kind of a dream map for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that makes sense as a phrase, but I think what I meant, it comes back to something we were talking about earlier, where I was talking about how we use the outer world to make sense of the inner. That's just one of the ways in which we've made metaphor over the history of our species. A metaphor is one of the ways we live and make sense of ourselves. We talk about inner and upper and outer and under, and these are the metaphors we live by. And Thomas really imagined his life in terms of paths leading into forests, leading to crossroads. This was how he kind of modeled decision making and being, if you like. So he did so more intensely than most people, I think, because he spent so much time walking on foot, following these paths. And eventually he imagined himself at a fork in the road, and Frost and various other things pushed him to take what I would say is completely the wrong decision. Left his wife, his children, signed up, didn't need to enlist. Went off to the front to show his fortitude, and of course the machine of industrial war just mulched him.
There's a slip of paper left in his pocket. His body, when he was killed, it was found. Would you talk about this moment? And maybe I could talk you into reading that section at the end of the book. Does that give too much away? I don't know how you feel about that.
No, that's absolutely fine. I mean, I would love to talk about that. I find it still incredibly shiveringly moving, even after all these years of thinking about it. And I should say that I was lucky enough to be be in New York, where a lot of Thomas's notebooks are held at the New York Public Library Berg Collection last year. And they don't have this notebook, but they have his early notebooks when he was a kid, really. When he was a young naturalist out in the field, and when he was walking in his 20s and 30s, they're such bright documents. They're absolutely scintillating with the details of the everyday. And you know, when you pick up a notebook from an archive, or you hear those voices so freshly because they're coming through handwriting, through pencil lead that's right there in front of you. Anyway, Thomas carried in his war years, his war weeks, I should say, because he didn't last very long out there. He didn't write poems, but he kept a diary. The diary is an astonishing document, kept in a little Walker's Backloop pocketbook, which still has the ripple marks on it, which we think were left by the detonation of the shell that killed him, or the pneumatic concussion of the shell that killed him. And he kept a diary, which was remarkable because it hardly mentions the war. It's basically all about birds and plants, which sounds like an abdication of the responsibility of vision, but in fact is clearly just, you know, it's protection, it's defense, it's beauty in the face of horror. He's killed. We don't know quite how. And the contents of his pockets are returned to Helen in a box, his wife. Maybe I'll just read you this couple of paragraphs. There is the diary, and inside it, a photograph, a loose slip of paper and a creased letter. The letter is from Helen to Edward. The photograph is of Helen. The slip of paper has addresses and names written on one side, and on the other, three jotted lines in pencil. Where any turn may lead to heaven, or any corner may hide hell. Roads shining like river uphill after rain. What was Thomas seeing as he wrote those last verses in his Arras notebook? The old ways of the south country of England, or the shell-swept support roads that wound to the front? Both, perhaps, folded together, the one kind of path having led in its way to the other.
You mention how Edward Thomas not only thought on paths, but that he was also with them. Say something about that, because I think this gets us back around to the kind of walking that we're all doing these days, that, you know, thinking on one hand, but are, you know, it seems to get at the idea of the being present with the path, being present in the walk.
That's a lovely way of putting it, being present with the walk or in the walk. Maybe that's it. So on the one hand, these paths led Thomas back in history, back in time, as they do me, as they do many of us. On the other, they're just brightly, pristinely present moments. I mean, I sometimes say, well, you know, what's more contemporary than birdsong? It's sort of, and it's so bright on our ear now, as I don't know if it's true where you are, but, you know, traffic's down almost to zero. There's no airplane noise. And suddenly the dawn chorus here in springtime England it's mad. It's just this crazy silver orchestra just blaring away. And people are saying to each other, what, where did these birds come from? And the answer is they were always there. It's just, we didn't hear them. So unmasked and walking was a means of unmasking for Thomas. He could be present in the moment. He could escape his depressions, his worries about money and masculinity and all the rest of it. And I think perhaps all of us recognize some version of that as we live obsessively in the future, trying to forecast the end to this pandemic, scrying the entrails of the news, trying to augur the end of lockdown. And a walk suddenly perhaps breaks us out of that briefly, and we live in the moment again. That's a good place to be, at least temporarily right now.
Robert McFarlane, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Robert McFarlane. He's a fellow of Emmanuel College at Cambridge University. His book is The Old Ways, A Journey on Foot. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Twe, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.